This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, Black history is rapidly being erased from the nation's classrooms. A black man gets the death penalty on the theory that black people are more dangerous than whites. And President Obama signs on for 3 years of war, war, and more war in Syria and Iraq. But first, we'll hear from Asantewa Nkrumah Ture, one of the organizers of a rally against the Congressional Black Caucus at the group's annual conference next week. Activists are outraged at the Black Caucus's close ties with apartheid Israel, its subservience to the giant telecom corporations that are trying to take over the Internet, and the fact that most caucus members have supported the militarization of police forces across the country. Ms. Nkrumah Ture says the Black Caucus's unanimous vote to give Israel a blank check to bomb Gaza was the last straw.
What this recent murderous bombing of Gaza by apartheid Israel that began on July the 8th, we felt that that was indeed the straw that broke the proverbial camel's back. As you know, as your listeners and readers know, this recent bombing of Gaza was just horrendous. We saw children, we saw men and women killed, we saw their battered bodies, we even saw how entire families were destroyed by this bombing by apartheid Israel. So we just said enough is enough, so we wanted to do this rally.
Early on in the Israeli attack on Gaza, the House passed a resolution. It passed unanimously, basically giving Israel a blank check. Every single one of the Congressional Black Caucus members went along with, affirmed, voted for that resolution.
Yes, that was most disturbing because, as you know, the Congressional Black Caucus also includes two Muslim members, Congressman Andre Carson of Indiana and Congressman Keith Ellison of Minnesota. So it was terrible to see that. This also included such respected leaders as Congressman John Conyers of Michigan and Congresswoman Maxine Waters of California and, of course, even Barbara Lee of California. So it was very, very sad to see how they did that and also to see how quickly they did that. As you know, the bombing began on a Tuesday, July the 8th, and by that Friday, July 11th, they had passed this resolution. They wasted no time.
In past years, we could at least have expected some of the members to abstain, but they seemed to be afraid even to do that.
Yes, that again, too, was very disturbing. They didn't even bother to abstain. They just went along with it. So again, it's well past time for us to hold them accountable. And we're hoping with this rally and with the news media coverage of it, we want to start a conversation nationally regarding the Congressional Black Caucus. We want to more closely examine their voting record. We want to really look at more closely how they arrive at these positions and why do they do the things that they do.
This black political class tries to derive much of its credibility from links, real or imagined, to the civil rights movement, to the battle against American apartheid, and yet they are identified to a man and woman with Israeli apartheid.
Yes, and much of the quote-unquote progress we as people of African descent in this country have achieved is due to the civil rights movement, the black power movement, et cetera. So to ride on that, to be elected to Congress, and yet to fail to live up to that responsibility can be called nothing but a deliberately cowardly act. Not only regarding the Congressional Black Caucus supporting apartheid Israel's quote-unquote right to self-defense, but also their position on net neutrality, also their position in their ties with corporate America, and various other issues, and even more recently looking at what happened in Ferguson, Missouri. As you know, Congressman William Lacey Clay from Missouri, whose district includes Ferguson, back in June, he supported legislation introduced by a congressman named Grayson, and it was to call for the demilitarization of U.S. police departments in the United States. Well, as we saw, Congressman Clay voted to continue the militarization of U.S. police departments. So, in effect, Congressman Clay voted to militarize the police of Ferguson, Missouri, and we saw all the firepower they brought on the unarmed protesters of Ferguson, Missouri. And, of course, their protest was righteous due to that unfortunate death of Mike Brown, who was just a teenager.
Yes, in fact, 27 of the Congressional Black Caucus members voted against the Grayson Amendment, and 5 abstained, for a total of 32 out of 40 voting members. And yet, many of them would have you believe that this vote never happened, and they've been against militarization all along.
Well, yeah, this is why it's important for us to have this rally. This is why it's important for their constituents across the country to pay closer attention to the voting records of members of the Congressional Black Caucus. How do they make these decisions? How do they do these kind of things? Another example, I think it was maybe a year or two ago, several members of the Congressional Black Caucus made a visit to Israel. Why were they in Israel, given some of the severe and more serious problems in their districts with the unemployment, with the takeover of our public schools, with other issues, very, very critical issues going on that adversely affect their constituents? Why did they make the time to go and make a visit to Israel? That needs to be explained as well. Did a firm up there getting campaign contributions from AIPAC, the American Israel Political Action Committee? What purpose did that trip serve? These are the kind of things we need to look at. So we're calling on people to join us on Wednesday morning, September 24th, 9 a.m. sharp, in front of the Convention Center here in Washington, D.C., where we will have, we hope, hundreds of people carrying signs that said shame on the Congressional Black Caucus.
But thousands of people are coming, and they're hoping to come to a party. You seem to be intent on crashing the caucus's party.
Well, in serious times like these, there is no time for parties and the different prayer breakfasts and the wine tastings and the jazz night and other kinds of activities they've done over the years. And even if you've ever been to the Congressional Black Caucus, the convention hall is just filled with all the exhibits from corporate America, the different kind of corporations that practice racism against our people, that practice all types of pollution against communities, those that come from the war industry, war profiteers come and exhibit. And they pay big, big money to exhibit. And we're hoping that the media comes and sees our rally, and we hope they go inside the conference and ask certain members of the Congressional Black Caucus, why did you vote this way regarding apartheid Israel's right to self-defense? Why did you vote in support of telecommunication companies that would threaten the public's access to the Internet? And what that means in terms of jobs, in terms of education, et cetera. Why are you so closely tied to different corporations of corporate America? These are the kind of things we want people to ask, and hopefully they will join us.
Asantewa Nkrumah Touré, an organizer of the Shame on the Black Caucus rally, September 24th in Washington. Dwayne Buck was sentenced to die in Houston, Texas, after his own lawyer called in an expert witness to testify that blacks who kill are more likely than whites to kill again. Mr. Buck appealed his death sentence with assistance from the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund. A federal district court judge agreed that the testimony exposed Buck to racial prejudice, but then the judge ruled that he could be executed anyway. We asked Legal Defense Fund litigation director Christina Swarns, how could a judge allow a man to be put to death on the theory that black people are inherently dangerous?
This is a critical fact in this case, because in Texas, the only way you can get a death sentence is if the jury finds that you're likely to be a future danger. So having an expert say that Mr. Buck had an immutable characteristic that made him more likely to be dangerous in the future was damning for this case. As you know, we've been appealing the introduction of race in this case for quite a while, the NAACP Legal Defense Fund and the Texas Defender Service, and attorney Kate Black represent Mr. Buck. And on August 29th, a judge in the Southern District of Texas in federal court agreed with us that his attorney's decision to call an expert he knew, the attorney knew the expert was going to rely on evidence connecting race to future dangerousness, was, in her words, repugnant and reckless. You know, she says it was both repugnant and reckless for a defense counsel in a capital case to call a witness who would link his client's race with the likelihood of future dangerousness. So, you know, on that point, we agree. But then, shockingly, notwithstanding her acknowledgement of the absurdity of trial counsel's decision, she concludes, well, but that's okay. In the context of this case, there's no error. He was not prejudiced by this behavior. I don't understand, putting it charitably, how one can reconcile those two points. Counsel's decision here was shocking and horrendous. And it's not just a simple mistake, a technicality, a small issue, error that counsel did here. This is asking a jury in the United States to rely on race to impose a death sentence. You know, there's a long history in this country that can't be ignored of linking race to dangerousness and linking race to lynching and death sentences. So the play on that kind of fears, the history, the stereotypes in a Houston courtroom, it is inconceivable to me that the ultimate finding would be that a lawyer could introduce that kind of evidence, but it would not be harmful to a black defendant.
Yes, in courtrooms across the country and in Houston in particular, juries hand down death sentences disproportionately to blacks without that kind of so-called evidence being introduced. But the judge apparently did not believe that introduction of testimony that basically said that blackness is an inherent and lethally dangerous characteristic created an unfair trial.
That's right. And I think the thing that is remarkable about this is that, as you point out, we know that this suggestion is made all over courtrooms in America. Here it is explicit. You know, it's not an allusion to animal imagery. It's not the kind of things that we often see prosecutors do in cases, capital cases and non-capital cases across the country, suggesting a link between race and criminality, race and violence. Here, it was absolute expert testimony of the existence of such a link that the jury could and should rely on to conclude that Mr. Buck should be sentenced to death. So it is absolutely shocking. It is stunning. It is appalling. And it sets a terrifying precedent for attorneys going forward, for people who are in the criminal justice system, and really for the African-American community overall.
Well, certainly, even as a layman, it would seem that Mr. Buck was not given benefit of counsel.
Exactly. Most people cannot even begin to imagine, right? If you say the sentence, hey, you know, is it fair, reasonable constitutional counsel to have your lawyer stand up and present a witness who says you're more dangerous, you're more likely to commit another crime because of your race? No one would answer that question yes, except that's what happened here. This federal judge said it was.
Well, does all this make you confident on appeal?
No, it doesn't make us confident on appeal. I will say that we will aggressively appeal this because we are confident that that decision is wrong. We are confident that the law is on our side, and we are confident that if the law is fairly applied to Mr. Buck's case, he will prevail. So there is no question and there is no doubt in our minds that we will continue to fight this case and pursue justice on Mr. Buck's behalf, because if this decision is allowed to stand, everyone in this country should be very concerned about our criminal justice system.
Christina Swarns of the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund. New York City Police Commissioner Bill Bratton took his Broken Windows policing show before the City Council last week. The commissioner defended his crackdown on petty offenses like selling loose cigarettes, as Eric Garner was doing when police put him in a fatal chokehold last July. Bratton claims there's nothing wrong with the NYPD that a little extra training can't cure. We spoke with Josmar Trujillo of New Yorkers Against Bratton. Trujillo said the problem isn't poor training, but lack of justice.
It was probably the last thing, I think people in this city who are fighting issues of police brutality and issues of racial profiling and systemic racism overall, it's probably the last thing that we wanted to hear, that the solution to the problems with the New York Police Department, which are historic, were going to be, in Brad's own words, some refresher courses and a 3-day training course at a cost to us, the taxpayers, of somewhere around $30 million. And in the same hearing, we also heard Bratton agree with this city council, which has been very pro-police in 2014, as far as we've seen, also suggest that we might be putting more cops onto the streets, maybe hiring over 1,000 more police officers, predictably the ones that are going to have to go into communities of color. So the hearing was not just not hearing what we wanted to hear, which was a conversation on broken windows and the core roots of the problem with our relationship with the police, but it was just the reverse. We heard the last things that we wanted to hear, which was going to be more police and more taxpayer money going into the police department.
So in 3 days, Bratton's going to undo 300 years of white supremacist mental conditioning.
Well, he's definitely bought himself some time with the training conversation, because the one thing that we know with Bratton is once he digs his heels in on something, it's really hard to get anyone to put pressure on him because he has so much clout in elite political circles and in the media. So, yeah, he was able to kind of brush off all the criticism that was coming from the grassroots level, which was almost universally around not just the brutality, but the philosophies and the strategies that put these cops into these antagonistic relationships with us, which, of course, goes back to historic relationships that the police have had with people of color. So he very astutely sidestepped it, and, you know, unfortunately, very few city council members really pushed very hard on it. Now, the Speaker of the Council, Melissa Mark Viverito, was throwing some very softball questions up there. And I know that the mayor, even though he wasn't at the city council hearing, he's reiterated his support not only for Bratton, but for the broken windows theory.
Well, Bratton says he has plenty of black elected officials and Latino elected officials in agreement with him. And it appears that Sharpton is on board, saying that what's needed is training for the police.
Yeah, so a lot of political leaders buy into both Bratton and de Blasio, because I think at this point you have to see them like a package deal to kind of buy in this rhetoric of, you know, we're going to reform or we're going to do something. But I think at the grassroots levels, you're going to see that people really understand this as something that's so far beyond training that the suggestion of training is almost like a slap in the face. And it's an insult to our intelligence for people who've been following this, for people who've been in this movement in the city for the last 20 years, where we've had hearings, we've had suggestions about trainings. This police department is one of the most trained police departments in the world. It sets precedence in terms of training throughout the country. Training isn't the issue. The systemic culture of brutality, which is reinforced by institutional racism, by the prejudices in our society, are really, you know, the conversation that needs to be had. And the fact that we're able to kind of somehow avoid that is a loss to the community, because we've put so much time and effort into trying to raise consciousness and raise awareness around this, and we're getting just more theater, more nothing.
And broken windows, the attention to so-called quality of life crimes, is really just like stop and frisk. It requires constant surveillance of people on the streets and constant contact with them, pressure upon them.
Absolutely. And in some ways, I think broken windows is perhaps even a little worse than stop and frisk, because with stop and frisk, when I've been stopped and frisked, I've been generally let go. With broken windows, because they're stopping you for a small quality of life crime, which are, you know, as the Daily News pointed out the other day, which could be like walking an unlicensed dog, jaywalking, spitting on the curb, riding your bike on a curb, loitering, disorderly conduct, which we know are kind of like these catch-all charges that police officers kind of just throw at people. These are the types of things that you actually don't walk away from. You'll get either a summons, you can go to jail. I spent a night in jail for having a foot up on a subway seat before. So in many ways, it's actually worse than stop and frisk, because now you're actually potentially criminalizing people. You're putting people into financial straits with some of the fines and everything. So it's a different conversation somewhat, but it does mirror the kind of the racial disparities. And the Daily News, they were even able to find these disparities just by checking the numbers. And the disparities are not just that people of color are getting these broken windows types enforcements in their own neighborhoods. but that they're also getting them when they go into white neighborhoods, which was another big thing with the stop and frisk, that we knew that these types of policing practices were following us into white affluent neighborhoods. So it wasn't just that our neighborhoods had high crime. It was that police officers somehow found more criminality in people of color, which, again, this is something that has been a historic relationship with the police and communities of color.
Yes, with stop and frisk, the officer approaches a person with the intent to question that person and possibly frisk him. But with broken windows, the officer approaches the person with the intention of attaching a specific offense to that person.
Absolutely. And then there was also an important report a few months ago that said that the issues with broken windows were also that they created a back door to stops and frisks. So you can have potentially someone stopped for a low quality of life crime, and you can also, the police officer can kind of have a little bonus with you and also stop and frisk you for something. So even though, like, you might stop somebody for, you know, let's say I was jaywalking or something like that, they could also frisk me after that. And there was actually a legal memo that was leaked to someone from the New York Civil Liberties Union that said that in cases like this, that they didn't have to actually record the frisk if it was done after a legitimate stop for another small level crime. So these are frisks that aren't being recorded, and people should probably keep that in mind when people throw out statistics that say stop and frisk is down 80% or it's down 70%. There's a lot more ways to create interactions between police and people of color, and we know that. And broken windows is a historic one, but it's also a way to kind of do it now without doing the kind of the politically tainted stop and frisk now. I mean, like I said, there's a legal memo that said from the city that said that you can actually frisk people after a legitimate quality of life crime without having to record it at all.
So the policy that led to the death of Eric Garner in Staten Island still stands and is being defended.
Absolutely. I mean, we're getting down to the core of the philosophies and the theories that guide the New York Police Department. So they're going to sink their feet in. The political establishment here with this progressive mayor reiterates their support for it. This isn't like stop and frisk. Stop and frisk was one tactic that was done in the spirit of kind of a racist philosophy that guided the police department 20 years ago when broken windows was first introduced. But obviously it also goes beyond broken windows. We've had racist policing since before the 90s as well. So we're getting down a little deeper now. Stop and frisk in many ways was the tip of the iceberg, but now we're getting down a little further down into that iceberg. Ultimately, at the end of the day, the issues are going to be beyond just one policing theory, beyond one tactic. But these are basically codified forms of racism, where they're able to find ways to criminalize and harass people, up to and including fatal encounters with people, like with Eric Garner. So we have to go deeper and not just have victory laps whenever we get a city council bill or we get one piece of legislation. We've got to be willing to push harder and deeper, because believe you me, the police department, it doesn't reform in the sense that there's changes. It reforms in the sense that it transforms into something that can adapt, but it's ultimately still racist at the end of the day.
We must go deeper in order to reveal what really makes for a police army of occupation.
Absolutely. And I think people in New York City need to, you know, even though we've had the history of being able to push back against the police department in the last few years, some people have said that New York has gone soft. And I think we have to look at places like Ferguson. We have to look at places where there are real bastions of resistance and rebelliousness to kind of re-energize ourselves. Because ultimately, we cannot rely on the political establishment. We cannot rely on mayors, on anyone, no matter what their rhetoric is. We have to be able to have that spirit of resistance. And Ferguson is right now, I think, giving it the best across the country.
That was Josmar Trujillo of New Yorkers Against Bratton. President Obama has told the world to expect that American bombs will be dropping on Iraq and Syria and who knows where else for the next 3 years. We spoke with Dr. Tony Monteiro, the esteemed scholar and political activist based in Philadelphia. Dr. Monteiro says Obama is taking humanity to new levels of danger.
He is bringing us to the brink of global war. Because Syria is not Libya. Syria is not even Iraq. Syria has allies that neither of those countries had. In fact, the attack upon Syria is an attack upon Iran and is an attack, in a certain sense, upon Russia, certainly Hezbollah, and it is an attempt to rearrange the political alliances and the military alliances in that region to go forward with the war against the Assad regime in Syria as a step towards Iran. This is dangerous. I think it brings humanity closer to world war than we have been maybe in 80 years. And the great irony is that the first black president is the president that brings us, the nation, and brings humanity closer to a global conflagration than any white president, probably in the 20th century.
It seems that Obama is doubling down on his policy of arming, further training these so-called moderate rebels. And there's a consensus, even in the corporate media, that such moderate rebels don't exist.
Precisely. The war in Syria is being won by the government of Syria and its military. The so-called moderates basically ceased to exist outside of press conferences maybe a year ago. They had been defeated primarily by the al-Nusra Front and its allies. And so there is no moderate opposition to the Assad government. It is all extreme, gangster, thuggish militants who are funded by the very people, some of the very nations that are part of the coalition of the willing, Saudi Arabia, Qatar in particular. Now, of course, the hidden hand in all of this is the Israeli government and the Israeli military on the ground in Syria, in Saudi Arabia and Qatar, training these militant jihadists. The big question I think we have to ask, I think everybody's asking, where did this Islamic State, this ISIL, come from in the first place? Suddenly they appear. Clearly, it is a creation of the West, trained and equipped by the Saudis, the Qataris, and the Israelis. And so that's where we are right now.
It also appears that this administration, certainly the corporate media, is investing heavily in painting President Assad as somehow an ally of ISIS, much in the same way that the Bush administration was able to convince lots of Americans that Saddam Hussein of Iraq was a friend of al-Qaeda.
Yeah, well, this is all a part of the great disinformation campaign to justify going to war. The Assad government is a force for stability in that part of the world, a force for progress, and of course part of the axis of resistance, as it is called. If the Assad government falls, then you have chaos and perhaps a government that would be controlled by people like the ISIL and the al-Nusra Front, these extreme gangster jihadists.
The logic of defeating ISIS or ISIL would appear to be to make common cause with Assad, who's been fighting these jihadists of all kinds for the last 3 years. But that goes contrary to U.S. objectives in the region, which are, of course, to overthrow Assad.
And I don't think this thing is about defeating ISIL. I don't think that's what it's about. I think this is about bringing down the Assad regime. Something they failed to do when the Assad government is winning at this point. The other thing is something close to regime change took place in Iraq a week or so ago with the overturning of the Maliki government. Now, I'm no fan of Maliki, but Maliki was aligned with Assad and the Iranians against ISIL and against the U.S. policies there. He had to therefore go. I think the target is the Assad government, not ISIL, and the targeting of the Assad government is the targeting ultimately of Iran and indirectly to create a hostile environment on the southern flank of Russia. And thus they will have hostile forces confronting the Russian government both on Russia's west in Ukraine and on the south from Syria and such.
President Obama's friends among the kings and emirs and other royals of the oil-rich states seem to be in a state of disarray themselves, carrying out a proxy war between each other, certainly in Libya.
I agree with you completely. Unless the objective is to so destabilize North Africa and the Middle East at this point, and then coming in later on, when all of the forces of resistance have been defeated and installing their own regimes. Chaos for the time being, transitioning to regime change down the road. Now, of course, it creates the most dangerous conditions for people, not just in that region, but for the world. Because, again, you are threatening Russia. And with the Putin government saying that they will stand up to this type of aggression. And, of course, the allies of Russia, China, those nations in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, these alliances that are economic but also have a political and military character to them would stand up and defend themselves against renewed aggression from the Anglo-American organized front of aggression.
A ceasefire is in effect in Ukraine.
Yeah, we have a ceasefire for the time being. We don't know what's down the road. We all know, and everybody admits, it's a temporary ceasefire. The West is imposing, the EU is imposing new sanctions on Russia as we speak. These are hostile sanctions. These are acts of economic warfare against Russia. And we all know that these types of sanctions are only a prelude to a military activity. So I would not feel any way good about this ceasefire. I think it's only temporary. And I think the Obama administration and the U.S. regime, period, is committed to endless war. And the objective is to so transform the planet in such a way that there can be no resistance or questioning of American empire and American hegemony.
So you're saying that a U.S. strategy of chaos is in full effect?
That's right. And I would put chaos and endless war. And you know, Glenn, these types of small wars have generally been preludes to general war. The other thing in this whole equation is the stagnant U.S. economy and the stagnant Western economies. And I don't know, and I don't have any special insight on the thinking of people that run the Western world and the Western economies. But there are some of those who believe that war is good politically and economically. Because, you know, war can be a justification for repression at home, for the limiting of speech, and so on at home. A lot of them believe that war can stimulate economies. Get economies out of stagnation and recession. So you get this double movement of economic stagnation and war throughout the world, which in the past has led to fundamental changes to the regime that have initiated the wars themselves. I think we're looking at something that we have not experienced in our lifetimes.
Certainly we have not seen a rapprochement and a growing military as well as economic alliance between Russia and China in very, very, very long time. Is that progressing?
I don't think that China has an option in this matter. The pivot to China or the pivot to Asia of the Obama administration, you know, that pivot can come through the Pacific or it can come through Iran, it can come through the Middle East, coming east rather than just from the west of China. The out for China is an alliance with Russia and with India, in spite of the conservative right-wing government that is running India right now. India doesn't have options outside of an alliance beyond its alliances, let us say, with Israel and the United States. It has to. It has to, in its own interest, in its own self-defense, see some sort of coalition with Russia and China. At that point, the West, and especially the United States, is confronted with a new set of issues that it will have to decide. Because now it's not just Russia, but it's Russia and China. Or it's not just China, but it's China and Russia and perhaps India. And then to look more broadly, it is all of those nations in the, what we call the Middle East, Syria, Iran, and possibly a refocusing of governmental power in Iraq away from a puppet regime towards an ally of Syria and Iran. So you get these new alliances, defensive alliances, against the United States' militarization of global economic and political relationships. If I were to say what gives me hope, it is the inevitable and necessary moving together of nations that for many decades had been hostile to one another. And the two big ones are China and Russia, but also India.
It appears that the unrelenting pressure from Washington and its allies is forcing China and Russia to conclude agreements and behave in ways that they were reluctant to before, that imperialism is creating its own more unified adversaries.
Definitely. And don't think that Russia and China don't have a historic memory, especially of World War II. And I don't think that either of those countries want to go through that again. And therefore, their alliance is an alliance for peace, a defensive alliance against the militarization of human relationships, of global economic and political relationships by the United States and its allies. I think another big part of this is the economic consequences of the sanctions upon Russia, and now Russia and China moving to trade no longer in dollars, but in renminbi and in the ruble. This is very, very important. The decline of the U.S. dollar as a reserve currency, but in fact, the decline in the value of the dollar itself as a result of these sanctions. I would hope that the BRIC nations, who are talking about establishing their own kind of world bank, the BRIC bank, would move away from the dollar as the reserve currency of the BRIC bank and somehow find a way that a basket of currencies or a couple of currencies would be their international trading currency rather than the dollar. Part of what allows the United States to be able to conduct war without end, to threaten nations, is because the U.S. dollar is the reserve currency. So the U.S. can conduct war by just printing money. And in a certain sense, the rest of the world, because it is using the dollar as the reserve currency in international commerce and trade, is indirectly financing America's war on the rest of the world. A big irony, a big contradiction that could be resolved in this period of American overreach, where China and Russia join together and begin the process of rejecting the U.S. dollar as the currency of trade, where the BRIC nations, which constitute something close to 40% of the global economy, could use other currencies than the dollar. That would weaken the capacity not only of the United States to dictate economic relations and trade relations and give the United States this upper hand over other nations, but it would weaken the capacity of the U.S. warmakers to print money at will to finance wars of aggression throughout the world.
And finally, during his first couple of years in office, Obama apologists would say that the president inherited these wars from his predecessor, George Bush. But now Obama has amassed his own legacy.
No question. And that goes back to 2011 and the war on Libya. And the people didn't want to see it by then. It was clear that Obama is a full-fledged neocon, that in foreign policy, this is Bush 2, but it is exponentially more dangerous neocon. I think this is the most right-wing foreign policy in America's history, the most dangerous foreign policy in the history of this nation. We are now what Germany was in the 1930s. We are the strike force of world imperialism. 800 bases in 128 countries, financing war by printing money, repression at home to silence the voices of anti-war. And then the most cynical of all things is to make a black man the representative of this regime. I think, however, that I like to look at the glass as half full. You know, sometimes bad times lead to people's awakening. I think that's happening. It happened with Russia. I mean, Russia, like China, had for a couple of decades played this unprincipled game with the United States and the West. You might remember that when they could have vetoed the UN Security Council endorsed bombing of Libya, China and Russia abstained. And in a sense now, the chickens are coming home to roost, and they have to do now what they should have done then.
Dr. Anthony Monteiro in Philadelphia. The United States has backed the rise of Nazis in Ukraine, as well as jihadist fighters in the Muslim world. We asked independent political analyst Eric Dreitzer if Washington is actually in control of all the groups that it gives arms and money to.
Well, I think it would depend on how we define control. If we think of control as direct operational control, then I would say that the United States does not necessarily control all of these forces. In that regard, I think it would be somewhat simplistic to think of the United States as some kind of direct puppet master behind every individual faction, every group, every terrorist network and extremist organization. However, if we think of control as a broader subject, as something that can include influence, that can include financial control, that can include bankrolling these forces, that can include providing them with strategic, with communications equipment, with many other facets, many other both material and financial support for these groups, then certainly, yes, the United States controls them. Yes, they are part of the U.S. orbit. They are part of U.S. hard power. This is an extension of the U.S. imperial agenda minus the U.S. troops. In other words, it is essentially contracting out, the way the United States contracts out seemingly everything these days, contracting out its wars, contracting out its war in Libya, its war in Syria, its war in Ukraine. And indeed, these are all connected, and indeed they have very striking similarities, if not they're entirely identical. That is to say, the United States purposely destabilizes a country in order to rid itself of a regime or of an elected government that was in opposition to its agenda, destabilize the country, overthrow a regime, allow chaos to reign, and out of that chaos, create a compliant puppet government or a puppet state. That is what the U.S. attempted in Libya with disastrous consequences. That is what it is currently and still attempting to do in Syria, using now ISIS as the newest, the latest pretext. And that's precisely what it's doing in Ukraine. In other words, the proxy wars that the United States has begun all over the world are part and parcel of a larger imperial agenda, an agenda that the United States has been following for a long time, but that in the 21st century has a strikingly different veneer.
So in a sense, it is the United States that has brought the caliphate to Syria and Iraq and Nazis to power in Ukraine.
Yes, indeed. And is that really not in keeping with the tradition of the United States of the 1970s and the 1980s in Central America, of the tradition that the United States had in places like Afghanistan, where it supported and created the Mujahideen in order to fight proxy war against the Soviet Union, where it sponsored fascist elements in Central America in order to create compliant puppet governments that it could control throughout the region? This is part of the U.S. agenda, and it has been for many decades. However, I think what we're seeing now is that the situation has become much more complex, that what the United States used to be able to get away with, it can no longer get away with in places like Ukraine, precisely because there is, of course, Russia and President Putin, which presents an obstacle to that, a roadblock on the path to hegemony in Eastern Europe, not only hegemony, of course, for the United States, but for its military arm in Europe, that being NATO. Now, in Syria, you have a very similar situation, a strategically critical country that the United States has long since attempted to destabilize and to use for regime change, and it is using a variety of elements, particularly the Saudi and Qatari financed terror networks streaming into that country, which now have taken on the form of ISIS. Remember, it is the United States which, since at least 2011, has been funneling arms and fighters across the Turkish border into Syria by using the CIA and the Muslim Brotherhood. This is what created the so-called Islamic State. This is not some organically evolving natural entity. This is a byproduct of U.S. foreign policy, just as the Nazis in Ukraine are a byproduct of U.S. foreign policy.
Eric Dreitzer in New York City, where he hosts the internet site StopImperialism.com. Every September, tens of thousands of discrimination cases are dismissed at the EEOC, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission in Washington. Ricardo Jones is a former top investigator for the EEOC in New York. We asked Jones why so many discrimination cases are dismissed in September.
The federal government runs on a fiscal year system. Their fiscal year begins 1 October. So they have to justify what they've done the whole fiscal year come the last month of the fiscal year, which is September. So in September, after the EEOC, its attorneys, investigators, and managers have basically bamboozled the public like they've been doing something, now have to dismiss a large number of African-American complaints to justify their existence so that they can get bonuses for dismissing complaints of discrimination, where 85 to 90% of those complaints are filed by African-Americans and foreign-born blacks. So every year, traditionally, they have to do the same thing in the fourth quarter of the fiscal year, which ends 30 September. So this month, there's mass panic at the EEOC because they got to dismiss as many complaints as they can to justify their existence and to get their bonuses for basically doing nothing.
The EEOC says that it dismisses cases most of the time, that the biggest reason is that there is a lack of evidence.
That's not true, Glenn. I mean, you only need the prima facie belief that you've been discriminated based on race. The unemployment figures show that there is a problem in this country with race discrimination, but because the administration is immune or is reluctant to deal with race issues, and we know this going back to Jeremiah Wright, also we've gotten information from Elijah Cummings, who is basically another pit bull for the administration and the president, who has put out information that they're not going to go forward on constituents' complaints of race discrimination. So we know in this country the president is sensitive to race issues, and he wants to pretend that there is not race discrimination.
Speaking of working Americans at the EEOC, the head of the union that represents the workers has submitted a list of 10 suggestions for the new head of the EEOC, and at the top of the list is a call to prioritize the hiring of frontline staff, more people, to trim a backlog of more than 70,000 cases and to cut down on the processing time of 9 months. Is there merit to that?
No, there isn't. Glenn Gabrielle Martin, the president of the employees union at the EEOC, AFGE, is in bed with the management of the EEOC. There is no backlog. The EEOC has been budgeted overtime. They have not paid any overtime to deal with the made-up backlog in the past 15 years. So 15 years of not paying overtime, the question is, what has been done with the misappropriation of overtime funds, which has basically been given to managers. Now we see why the president wanted to make sure that managers got overtime, because he's covering up the fraud and the corruption of managers using overtime anyway by saying now it's okay to give it to them. But the overtime was for investigations of the so-called backlog that doesn't really exist.
How long has this been going on in terms of the huge numbers of cases that are dismissed?
It's been going on, I say, since the Clinton administration, but it has gotten worse under the Obama administration, because many people thought that the slogan was, yes, we can, we're going to be transparent, and we're going to clean up, and we're going to do a better job. Yeah, they've done a better job of dismissing African-American complaints. And you can look at the statistics going back 10 years or 12 years, and you can see the dismissal rate of race discrimination for African-Americans under the Obama administration is basically almost 97%.
Compared to?
Compared to the best time was under Bill Clinton. Maybe Bill Clinton's was about 80%. But what does that say, period, even about Bill Clinton or George Bush? At least George Bush attempted to give the appearance of eradicating discrimination in the workplace. Barack Obama is not even worried about the appearance, because nobody's going to question him because he has the appearance of being black himself, and he's not black. He wasn't raised by black people. He didn't grow up in the hood. He didn't have to work at the jobs that black people had to work at to get money to get back into high school to get good grades and to go to college. He never had to do those things. So what does he know about working class black people struggling to get their children to college, and their children, once they're in college, having to work hard to maintain their existence in college? What does he know?
That was Ricardo Jones, a former investigator with the EEOC. On October 10th in New York City, Dr. Donald Smith, a founder of the National Alliance of Black School Educators, will be honored at a conference on Education for Liberation in the African American Tradition. Dr. Smith talked about the challenges facing blacks in the educational arena.
A major challenge, if not the major challenge, begins in the White House, with a president who does not believe in black culture as being essential to the education, not only of children of African descent, but of all American children. That's where it begins. And then it exists throughout the nation in state departments of education, in local superintendents of schools. So we revert right back to where we were in the middle 1980s when we were beginning to be successful in trying to include African-American culture for African-American children. We're back to square one.
Yes, we now see educational curriculums being stripped down to the bone, what they call the basics, but there seems to be no place for not just black history, but any history, any sociology, any exploration of what our world is about.
Any truth, absolutely. I don't see a great deal of difference now than when I first became a teacher in 1952, where African Americans were relegated to second class, not only in education, but in employment, housing, in terms of national respect. I don't see much difference. And we have a president who, though he is of African descent, does not want to acknowledge it and does not want to have anything mentioned African in his government.
How is that manifest in the president's educational policies?
It begins right at the top when he installed as his commissioner of education a man who never taught a single day and who was an abject failure as the head of education in the city of Chicago, where, again, as I said, he never taught a single day. Obama has not taken seriously the education of people of African ancestry, and that's tragic.
You say that Arne Duncan was an abject failure in Chicago, but it appears that the administration felt so highly about his conduct there that they made him the secretary.
I don't think that was the reason, his success in Chicago. I think that he was a basketball player, as Obama likes to think of himself. That was one of the major factors that resulted in Duncan's being established as the national head of education. He had no talent, he had no experience, but that doesn't seem to matter too much with some of the Obama appointments. If he likes the person and he thinks the person agrees with his philosophy, then Obama has no problem appointing him or her.
Largely as a result of his tenure in Chicago, black teachers have been decimated. Their numbers have been drastically reduced in that school system.
Absolutely. And the present mayor, who was elected because black people misunderstood who he was, they thought because he worked hand in glove with Obama, he must have been a decent person, and therefore they supported him wholeheartedly, has done everything he can do to close down black schools, to eliminate black teachers.
And that, of course, was Rahm Emanuel, former White House Chief of Staff. We're here in New York City with a mayor who is praised as a liberal breath of fresh air. And, of course, we're speaking of Mayor Bill de Blasio.
Yes, who has succumbed to the demands for more charter schools. And though he put up a dissent early on, has now agreed to support a major expansion of charter schools, which are of no substantial service to children of African descent.
The conference at which you are being honored says that it will present an action plan for black education for liberation. What kind of education is that?
That the education of African Americans has to include a substantial amount of information about African history and the achievements and successes of people of African ancestry, which largely has been denied, obliterated, ostracized in the school systems of the United States.
So are we seeing a kind of illiteracy among our own children in terms of black history?
Oh, absolutely illiteracy. In fact, in some instances, scorn for anything black. That follows the philosophy of the President of the United States. He never celebrates except on special occasions when he's expected to make some positive comment about black people and black history. But he does not follow through in his programs and policies and where he puts his money.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the black left. And while you're there, make plans to attend Black Agenda Report's 8th year anniversary celebration at historic Riverside Church in New York City. That's on October 24th. I'm Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.